Did churches have anything to do with the founding of America? Well, of course they did, if you know your history. And can churches help play a role in the renewal that America needs so desperately? Hello and welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is David Barton, who is a walking encyclopedia on America's Christian roots. He is the founder and president of Wall Builders. Well, I guess he's passed the presidency on to his son, and we're grateful for that, for the passing it on to the next generation. David, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jerry. Good to be back with you.
Okay, first of all, I've got a question for you. How did you get interested in this whole subject of American history? When you were young and you were growing up and so forth, you know, you obviously didn't always necessarily have these kind of views that, you know, my goodness, Christianity had a lot to do with creating America.
I had exactly the opposite views. I hated history. I was a math and science guy. I went to college on math and science scholarship, became a school principal, taught math and science, coached basketball. I wanted nothing to do with history. A lot of that goes back decades ago. I have a lot of white hair, so this goes back a long time. And when I was in sixth grade, my sixth grade history teacher specifically taught us that George Washington, this is quote, George Washington had 26 illegitimate children, giving new meaning to the phrase, Washington slept here. Now, I was a Christian at the time, and if that's Washington, I don't need anything with that country, and I don't need anything to do with it. I don't want to be part of something like that. And so I had no interest in history because that's what I was taught. Now, as it turns out, that is completely false. That is a lie of, and we're talking this time, late 50s, early 60s. So while we've got a lot of revisionist stuff going now, it was happening back then. And so I went from there, high school, college, et cetera, and had no interest in history. And what happened was, once I was a school principal, I came across two really old documents that actually covered things I had been taught in school, but when I read the actual documents, they were totally opposite to what school had taught me. And one of them actually was, I got to see George Washington's 1796 farewell address, the very last address that he gave publicly. And in that address, he talks about how that the only foundations for America are religion and morality. And he talked that if anyone tries to undermine religion and morality, they are not a patriot. I won't let them call themselves a patriot. I mean, he threw down the gauntlet. He put out a litmus test. I'm going, no, wait a minute. I was told George Washington was exactly the opposite here. And look at what he's saying. He's saying everything different from what my teacher told me. And then I started looking at George Washington, found out very different from what I'd been taught. And the other thing that got me going was when I was a school principal, you know, you can't have the Bible at schools and you can't have prayer at school, et cetera. Founding fathers didn't want that, separation church and state. And here's Washington saying, if you try to remove religion and morality, then you're not a patriot. And that didn't make sense for what our policies were. And I ran into an old Supreme Court case from back in the early 1800s. It was a unanimous decision where the U.S. Supreme Court said, look, if you're going to have a government-run school, you have to teach the Bible in a government-run school. We're not going to have a government-run school in America that doesn't teach the Bible. I'm going, what? That's an 8-0 decision? That's exactly opposite to what I was taught. And then that court quoted a number of founding fathers on why that was the position. And so at that point, it was really clear to me that what I'd been taught in history was not what actually happened. And so we started collecting the originals, and now we have about 160,000 original items from American history, from Columbus all the way forward to where we are right now.
What was that Supreme Court decision from the early 1800s?
The case was called Vidal versus Girard's executors. It came where that the government of, or actually you would say the city of Philadelphia was running a school that had been started by a man named Stephen Girard. Stephen Girard came to America after the American Revolution, but he was an atheist, and he didn't want religion anywhere part of it. So he started the school, gave it to the city of Philadelphia, so it is now a government-run school. And he had a provision that said, well, I don't want a single preacher setting foot on this campus. We're not going to have any of that with these kids. And so here you've got a school being run by the city and no religion allowed and no preacher on campus. And Daniel Webster argued that case in front of the Supreme Court and said, look, this is a clear attempt to keep the Bible away from students, because if you're not going to have a minister on campus, what would he talk about? He'd talk about the Bible. And so this is saying no religion, no Bible, no minister. And the court came back and said, no, you can't do that. If you're going to be a government-run school, you got to teach the Bible. And so that was the 1844 Vidal versus Girard's executors case. And in that, they quoted back to founding fathers like James Wilson, who was an original justice on the Supreme Court, signed the Constitution, signed the Declaration, quoted Judge Hopkinson, who was the signer of the Declaration. I mean, they went back to the original founding fathers. And so that was the one that really opened my eyes to history is very different than what I was taught. The court has a very different position than what I've been taught they've had since the 60s, and that's what got me into history.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, let me just, as a quick anecdote in reference to George Washington's farewell address, I once asked a similar question to Del Tackett of the Truth Project, which was a very popular series produced by Focus on the Family that he hosted. And there was some content in there about our, you know, America's true Christian roots. I remember him holding up the New England Primer. For all I know, it was one of your reprints of the New England Primer. My copy is that, and thank you for that again. But I once asked him, so how did you get interested, you know, in this whole Christian approach to, you know, truth, and which includes our, you know, our godly heritage, etc.? He said, well, I wasn't even thinking in terms of the culture and that kind of thing and our history and so forth. But when I heard an actor portraying George Washington delivering George Washington's farewell address, it got my notice and got my attention. And it was like, is this true? I mean, so I studied it and realized, oh my goodness, maybe we've been sold a bill of goods these days when it comes to, you know, what the founders intended in America. So I asked the question at the very opening, did churches have anything to do with the founding of America? That's a very leading question, but go ahead and wax eloquent, if you would, on that very issue.
Well, you can ask either the friends or the enemies, and they both say yes. And I'm talking at the time of the American War for Independence. It's interesting that a British loyalist here, Oliver, complained about what he called the Black Robe Regiment, those preachers. And preachers back in that day wore black robes. And he complained that these are the guys that are responsible for this. If it wasn't for these preachers, America would be a happy British colony. They wouldn't have this independence thing going. It's all these preachers that have stirred it up. And so you will find that in the American War for Independence, the highest attrition rate of any group, soldiers or anybody else, was preachers. When the British got a preacher and put him in prisoner of war camp, you're likely not going to see him again. There were 4,335 Americans that were killed by bullets, but there were 11,400 killed in prisoner of war camps. And that was a very high attrition rate among ministers. And it was very common for them to be leading congregations. If you look at the Battle of Lexington, it was Reverend Jonas Clark. He had his congregation out there taking on the British. At the Battle of Concord, which is the second battle in the Revolution, it was Reverend William Emerson, who had between 300 and 400 of his men out there facing the British. As you look at the third battle of the Revolution, which is called the Road to Boston, as Reverend Payson Phillips, Reverend Benjamin Balch had his congregations out there taking on the British. When you get to the fourth battle, the Battle of Bunker Hill, it was Reverend Joseph Willard who grabbed two companies out of his church and said, hey, let's get with the other churches and defend Boston. And so just battle after battle, these guys were up front, and the British did not like that. When the British landed in New York in 1777, first time in New York City is when they come in 77, there were 19 churches in town. They burned 10 to the ground. They desecrated the other 9. So they were after churches, after pastors. Then if you go long after the Revolution, you go to 1816, a young man named Hezekiah Niles, who would be a millennial of that generation. He had not been there for the War for Independence, but he had lived in America for several decades, loved what it had become. He wrote John Adams, who was an old man at this point, and this is 42 years after John Adams had signed the Declaration. And he said, look, I'm doing a history book. I wasn't there. You were. And I want to make sure I get this right. So who do you think are responsible for the ideas that led to American independence? Because we've become a unique nation. Our ideas, no other nation has been able to emulate. So where'd these ideas come from? And John Adams started listing pastors. He said, well, if you want to know, he said, you go back to the Reverend Dr. Samuel Cooper and Reverend Dr. Jonathan Mayhew. And he talked about Whitfield, and he talked about Reverend Charles Chauncey. And so here's a guy who was a key leader in the American independence movement, pointing to pastors. And it's significant that when you look at the Declaration of Independence, every single right set forth in the Declaration of Independence, historians have not documented that those rights had been preached from the American pulpit prior to 1763. So the Declaration of Independence is nothing more than a listing of sermon topics that Americans have been listening to for 15 years leading up to the American War for Independence. So pretty easy to show that pastors and churches were definitely involved.
Well, now, as you have tried to get the message out, obviously in many schools today, kids are learning the kind of almost a worse example of what you were talking about earlier, what you were exposed to as a child. In other words, at least back then, they thought of George Washington as a hero or Columbus as a hero. Now these guys are villains virtually.
Yeah, they are villains on things that they would never have been a villain for historically. It's interesting. I was just reading last week the official address that was given when the 13th Amendment was passed in Congress. And that 13th Amendment, when they passed that in Congress to abolish slavery in America, they asked the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett to come to Congress and preach a sermon on the abolition of the 13th Amendment. He was a black minister. He was pastor of 15th Street Presbyterian Church. He brought his choir. They had a two-hour service in the House of Representatives where he preached. And he was a significant civil rights leader, the same rank as Frederick Douglass at the time. And so Henry Highland Garnett, one of the most famous civil rights leaders in America, he said, man, he said, here we are. We finally abolished slavery. This is what George Washington is working for. This is what Thomas Jefferson is working for. This is what John Adams and Sam Adams were working for. And he went through and listed all the anti-slavery founding fathers. And he, as a black man, very educated, very engaged in civil rights, pointed to both Washington and Jefferson as being leading abolitionists. Now, you'll never hear that in school today. It's easy to prove if you go back to their writings and their works, and people say, well, but wait, they had slaves. They did. And Jefferson complained about that. He said, in Virginia, we're not allowed to free our own slaves. I inherited slaves. Well, that's Jefferson's thing in Washington. They inherited their slaves, and they inherited them, and they're not allowed to free them. But they both worked for abolition laws in the state. They both signed federal anti-slavery laws. Jefferson worked with nations around the world to end slavery. I mean, he hated slavery even though he owned slaves. Washington did as well. And in Virginia, they passed a strange law at the end of the Revolution that says, you know what, we just fought for our own freedom, so if you have slaves and want a freedom, you can do that. But you have to do it at your death. And so Washington was able to free his slaves at his death, but after Washington did that, the state went back and changed the law and said, no, I don't know what we were thinking. We shouldn't have let you do that. No more freeing the slaves. And so Virginia essentially made it almost impossible to free slaves, and you'll never hear that context today, even though Washington and Jefferson both talked about it in their day, and they both led anti-slavery. But it still is significant that we knew enough about American history that our black civil rights leaders praised Washington and Jefferson as great abolitionists. And now try to find that in any textbook today, and there's just nowhere you're going to see that. And by the way, it is significant to me that critical race theory that we talk about in schools today, you did not hear that 30 years ago. How come? Because Americans still knew too much about their history 30 years ago to buy into the nonsense of critical race theory. We have now been deprived of our history for so long that we're now believing things that were never true, that are easy to show were not true, but we know so little of our history that no one's even challenging it by and large.
Wow. We have 1 minute left. Are you hopeful for America as far as turning this thing around?
I am hopeful for America. It's interesting. I see the young people having a love for truth that I haven't seen in a long time. We do sessions of the summer for 18 through 25-year-olds, and we let them handle all these 160,000 items and see this stuff. And as they find what truth is, I have not seen a generation become as passionate for truth as what I'm seeing with this generation. So while there's still rough roads ahead, there is a rising tide of people who love the truth. These young people, they want the truth. They just didn't know what it was.
Okay, David Barton, thank you so much for being with us. Wallbuilders.org for more information. Appreciate all you're doing and all you're continuing to do. And what is your direct relationship between David and Tim as far as the organization in 10 seconds?
Tim is president and runs everything and has really turned the next generation on very good. I still produce a lot of the content, but he's inspiring the next generation, and that's really what we want.
All right. Thank you so much. All the best to both of you.
Bless you, brother.